10:35 here on Talk Radio about 70 KVI. Kirby in with you. David Bahnsen is the managing partner of the Bahnsen Group of Hightower Advisors. You can see him on Fox Business News and CNBC. He's talked about and written in Barron's, Financial Times, Forbes. He has a new book out, Crisis of Responsibility. I've got to say, this book actually made me think. This is a book that I enjoyed a lot. It made me think, and when I read it, I said, I've got to have David on the show to talk about it because I think it'll make you think, too. I think it's a must-read if there is such a thing. And David joins us now. David, thank you so much for taking time with us today.
It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
You bet. What is our crisis of responsibility?
Well, in the broadest sense, it is just the state of culture we find ourselves in whereby blame casting has become so prevalent that there seems to be a very difficult time moving the ball forward, making progress in the various endeavors that make for good civic life. We are so caught up with finding those scapegoats that we think are responsible, whether it be another person in our individual lives or in the broader sense, a force or institution or movement that we want to blame for our state of affairs. And I think that stems from what I do believe is not melodramatically called a crisis of responsibility.
And as you mentioned in the book, this is not just left or right. It seems everybody has their own boogeymen, their own things they blame for the way things are going. And left does it this way, right does it that way, people in the middle do it that way. It's a general phenomenon, not restricted to one particular political philosophy or political group.
Yes, that's right. And it's really kind of what incented me to write the book. I'm a lifetime conservative Republican and have always sort of found a certain part of blame casting to be systemic in much of the left and particularly far progressive left. And it's in the last 10 years, my study began out in the aftermath of the financial crisis, that I realized that the right is falling into this as well. Now, the thing that makes it challenging is there's a lot of kind of acceptability or legitimacy, if you will, to some of the things that we might want to target. I do believe the size of government's too big. I do believe that there are certain aspects of the global economy that have, been harder on certain groups of people than others. But the point I want to make in the book is that these things cannot be used to abdicate our own individual responsibility, that the kind of sacred honor that we have to live our own lives does not go away because of this external state of affairs.
You mentioned one thing that really caught me in the book is when you were talking about the financial crisis. You mentioned the role of envy and how envy is something that all sides was present in all sides. And I've always thought that envy was something that was misunderstood by a lot of people, but really lay at the root of a lot of the issues in our society.
Yeah, I think that that's exactly right. And of course, the whole concept of covetousness, of wanting something because your neighbor has it, is so old that it actually goes back to the Ten Commandments, the sort of magnum opus, if you will. The closing commandment of the Big Ten was indeed that prohibition against not coveting. And the financial crisis was one gigantic story of covetousness. That's basically, we had a covetousness crisis, an envy crisis, as much as the financial or housing crisis. Now, the point I make in the book is people that want to blame Wall Street are right, that there were traders and bankers in Wall Street that were making decisions based on their own envy of what another financial firm may be doing and what other bonuses a particular banker may be achieving. And I actually kind of walk through some of those specific stories, and I think at the root of it was the exact same thing that was at the root of Main Street's problem. It was that sort of keeping up with the Joneses level of envy that you're talking about.
Now, toward the end, and by the way, talking to David Bahnsen, he's the author of a new book called Crisis of Responsibility, Our Cultural Addiction to Blame, How You Can Cure It, and I highly recommend this book. I mean, I've not enjoyed a book this much in a very long time because it actually made me think. And toward the end of the book, after you analyze some of the issues involved, you go through a list of 10 things that people can do to help restore responsibility. And I've got to, David, I'll just say this. I've been in politics for a long time. I've been in media for a very long time. And a lot of people always talk about liberty, but I think liberty is balanced by responsibility. And the two go with each other. And I have thought for a very long time that the lack of responsibility, the failure of people to take responsibility, has been what's plagued our society in large part. You just said a lot better than I did. And so I enjoyed that. So I want to go through a couple of these steps you think that people need to take. And the number one is to repudiate defeatism and victimhood, even if you've been a victim. Repudiate that.
That's right. It's a fundamental mentality that we have to live our lives by. And that last phrase there that you repeated is a real important one, because I think there are times in which someone really was maybe victimized. Maybe they were genuinely mistreated. And yet, if we only succeed in repudiating defeatism and an attitude of kind of that victimization, when we actually weren't even defeated or victimized, we haven't really accomplished very much. The point is to not surrender to it, to not give into it, to not let it win. I've heard this phrase thrown around from time to time, and I think it's somewhat effective, that going into a victimization mentality is like drinking poison and expecting the other person to die. It just doesn't do any good for you to say, well, I've had a tough life, I've had this situation, out of this relationship or this professional contact, something went astray, and now you sort of live your life day by day, just sort of waiting for something to fall out of the sky to land on you. The fact of the matter is there's a lot of bad policy out there, as you and I know and mm-hmm. talk about in our day-to-day lives quite a bit. But those things are not being designed for the purpose of holding us down. The reality is that the people who are most successful in life and are living the most flourishing lives with most contentment, most joy, are people that did not have a lack of adversity. They're people that learned how to deal with adversity. And it may sound cliche, but if you think about how important that message is right now and what a difference it would make in the way that we go about dealing with some of the public policy, either challenges or even failures. The ability to supersede that and transcend into, I think, more fulfilling living will make for better civic life in addition to more fulfilling individual lives.
You have some advice for parents? Prepare your children for economic self-reliance.
Yeah, boy, isn't this one just incredible? It was somewhat unnecessary, I think, a generation ago. I'm sure that there were cases of enabling and coddling and things like that. But the data itself is rather clear. It was nowhere near as systemic as it's become. And I think that the basic concept that part of adulthood does include economic self-reliance. Each family and each situation may have different bandwidth for what kind of assist and what kind of boost one's going to get and receive. But as far as that kind of attitudinal approach to putting your children in a position of independence, I think that conditioning for economic self-reliance has the potential to totally change our society.
Have we extended childhood's perhaps the wrong word, but have we extended childhood in the sense that more and more kids go to school, become financially reliant, they stay at home? You don't really have the draft anymore, which made you grow up. If you were a male and 18, you had to go in the service. We don't have that anymore. Now you can have your kids on your insurance policy till they're 26. It seems to me that we're delaying that point at which the little eaglet leaves the nest and tries to fly on their own.
Well, I mean, the reason it seems that way is because it is, and then some. I think we're understating how severe it is. I'm not sure that I think it's too pejorative or too inflammatory to refer to it as continued childhood, because if you define adulthood as a period of independence, of capability, of being able to cope, and of course that's a continued arc, right? Like I mm-hmm. think that the young adult I was in my 20s is different than the somewhat more mature adult I am in my mid-40s. And I would like to think I'll be a more mature adult still into my 50s, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's sort of the idea. But we have really accepted as a society the idea that 18 through 30 it can be one big extended adolescence. David Brooks calls it the Odyssey phase. I'm not going to say in every case if a gap year in between 18 and 19 is a good thing or bad thing, but I'm not referring to a gap year or a semester. Mm-hmm. You know, if some young adult wants to go to Europe and backpack around or go to the mission field for a little bit or whatever, you know, I don't think that that's what I'm referring to. But to the extent that we're starting to see systemically people well into their late 20s, if not early 30s, with no economic self-reliance, I believe that it's a problem, and it isn't anomalies anymore. You can't write a book about outliers. So the data in chapter 3 of the book is showing how we've turned it on its head, that the amount of people that are getting a woman pregnant and not marrying her, it went from the inverse percent to what it is now. It is more than tripled in less than 40 years. The amount of men who are not married in their early 30s, either because they already had a divorce or because they never got married. So, look, there's plenty of situations people could look at and say, well, in this case, that case, I don't see that as big of a problem. But I'm saying systemically, right, that people who do not have, we right now have more people living at home than we have had since before World War II as a percentage of the population. And I think that that is a problem culturally far more than it is a problem in any public policy.
We're talking to David Bahnsen. He is the author of the new book, Crisis of Responsibility. I really, really suggest you pick up this book. It's Post Hill Press, and you can find it in local bookstores and also on Amazon. It's a short book. It's not that long, but I found a lot of wisdom in it. And I read a lot of books in this line of work, David, but there aren't many I really sit back and want to reread and learn a lot from. And yours did. It made me think about a couple things in a different way. You also say one needs to find their joy in production, not consumption.
Yeah, this is actually, of all the top 10 kind of individual points I gave there in Chapter 11 that you're kind of reading from now, and probably my favorite one. There's a certain almost sort of theological sense to it for faith-based people. There's definitely a very existential element to it. But, you know, I think that there's an undertone of economics into it. That and myself being an economist and one who works in finance for a living is very important in how this gets integrated into a life lesson. First of all, there's no such thing as consumption unless there's first production, and not just your production, but somebody else's. So someone else has to produce so that you can consume, and you have to produce so that you can consume.
Right.
Because once you have produced, you have the means to then go consume what someone else has produced, and it makes for the complexity and inner workings of a mature economy. The fact of the matter is that this is not merely an economic statement, but it also goes down to the core of our being. We were made to produce, and we have been trained to find joy in consuming. And so to the extent that we almost view production as a chore and the consumption as the dessert, I think that it makes for a society that it should be no surprise has a very difficult time finding joy and dignity. When we produce, we will inevitably get to consume. That is the kind of aftermath in the supply chain of things, if you will. And yet, that daily earned success that Arthur Brooks talks about, that satisfaction that comes from being a productive member of society that is internal and external. We get validation from our family. We get validation from our community. And most importantly, we go to bed at night knowing that we have accomplished something. It's good for self-worth. It's good for dignity. It's amazing. For 20-plus years of the self-esteem movement in our society, we haven't been able to figure out that it comes from productivity.
It comes from results and productivity and doing something you take pride in, something that you can show people you've accomplished, something you look at and say, I did that. This is where self-esteem comes from. I mean, you're right, they haven't figured that out yet, but it's where it comes from. Results and achievement bring about self-esteem. And unfortunately, it's taken a lot of people a long time to learn that, and some may never learn that. The book is Crisis of Responsibility, David L. Bonson. It's available in bookstores, Amazon near you. Really, my friends, I've read this book, and I've learned a lot. It made me think, and books don't always do that, and I think it will too, because ultimately, I believe we need to become more responsible for what we do, responsible for what we don't do, responsible for each other, and to build a better and more civil society, we need to do these things. And David, I think, has his finger on the pulse and points us in the right direction. And David, I so enjoyed the book. I'm so glad I got a hold of Jack Fowler, and Jack put you in touch with me. And we had a chance to chat. I hope we get a chance to chat again sometime. And best of luck with this book. It should be widely read.
Well, I sure appreciate that, and obviously appreciate Jack Fowler connecting us, all the good work the National Review guys are doing. You know, they're doing their part to put an end to this crisis of responsibility, so it's good to be a part of it.
All right, sounds good. Thank you, David. Have a great day.
You too. Thanks.
Have a good day. All right, we're coming up at